If you just played one note that was honest and it was true and it would hit you right in your midsection, you know. I've always said that he had probably one of the greatest sounds that I ever heard anybody play on saxophone.
And he could communicate the feeling, the blues feeling in what he played. That was his special gift, because Gene is all about feeling. You can hear it in what he does, anything he does. It's there. It's palpable. You can feel it.
Gene Ammons was able to put his voice through his horn in a way that touched people. And it had to do with his sound, had to do with his articulation, had to do with his soul. But ultimately, it just came down to the very immediate experience of hearing Canadian Sunrise and going, this guy's talking to me.
His sound was as big and broad-shouldered as the city he called home. Chicago's Gene Ammons had a raw power matched by a few saxophonists. Blessed with a perfect tone and a gut feeling for the blues, Ammons created a boxcar full of hits, only to lose everything to the curse of drug addiction. Though his musical gifts were equal to other jazz giants in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, Gene Ammons rarely got a second look by many of the jazz writers and critics of his era. I'm Nancy Wilson on this edition of Jazz Profiles, Remembering Jug, a tribute to Gene Ammons. When Gene Ammons walked on stage, you knew something big was about to happen. From his head to his toes, Jug, short for Jughead because of his large hat size, was a major presence. When pianist Junior Mance first played with Ammons in the early 1950s, he quickly discovered the big set of lungs driving that powerful tenor saxophone.
It was the biggest saxophone sound I'd ever heard in my life. But Gene was a pretty big man, though. He was well over 6 feet and built like a linebacker or a defensive end or something like that. You know? And he had the strength to do that. And his big sound was pure. It wasn't ragged or anything. It was like pure, wonderful, round sound.
And, unlike many of his fellow beboppers in the 40s and 50s, Ammons' best performances were those that relied on the fewest notes. Chicago tenor saxophonist Fred Anderson.
He always played these notes that was, they were simple, it was some simple stuff, but it was the way he would do it, you know, was very incredible, you know, and especially on the blues. I've never heard anybody play the blues like Gene Ammons.
Thank you.
was simply a master of knowing how to build a performance for an audience.
Producer and writer, Bob Porter.
He would open with something very fast. It was just one of these finger busters just to get the band warmed up. And then he'd take the mic and he'd start to talk to the audience, and the organ player would be playing very soft chords behind him, and gradually the intensity would build up, and then he'd go into one of his big ballads, Angel Eyes or Didn't We, or one of these things, and he'd just destroy the house at this point.
And it was more than the Titanic-like sound of Ammon's horn that created his major hits through four decades. Although Jug could blow the roof off the place, he could also silence a noisy crowd with a ballad. Chicago-based drummer and music historian Charles Walton heard the hush in many a crowd during a Gene Ammon solo.
It was as though each ballad he's playing, he's thinking about the words, and he's telling a story. A lot of musicians, older musicians, say you should know the words of a ballad. If you know the words, you're going to tell a story. If you can say the words and sing the words, you know. And that's seemingly what he would do.
A number of critics have compared Ammon's tenor playing with the best of jazz vocalists. Ira Gittler heard Dinah Washington when he listened to Jug. And a number of singers praised Gene as a singer's ballad player. For Billie Holiday, Ammon's voicing of My Foolish Heart topped her list. Tenor saxophonist Harold Osley.
I know a lot of times musicians describe it as saying, well, he gives thought to what he's playing. It's not just running off a lot of notes. You know, like maybe takes time to choose what he's going to do, and what he says on his instrument makes sense. It's a storyline.
It's the ability to roar and whisper with equal emotional immediacy.
Chicago-based writer Neil Tesser.
Many people can blow the roof off. But to be able to then just drop everything down and find the small spot within yourself that you have to be in touch with in order to communicate something very personal and intimate to a large crowd, that's harder. And it is unusual to find the two of them in one person. Thank you.
Chicago radio host and writer John Corbett.
He had a really strong musical personality. You could pick him out of a crowd instantaneously, and you could pick him out of a crowd playing long tones, because the way that he attended to his sound was unique. To me, he was of a generation where if you didn't have that, you were nothing. You had to have that. That was what kept anyone ever hiring you. To me, that rings true of the great musicians of today.
Gene Ammons' 1962 recording of You Go to My Head, with Mal Waldron on piano, Wendell Marshall on bass, and Ed Thigpen on drums. You're listening to NPR's Jazz Profiles. It's a tribute to tenor saxophonist Gene Ammons. I'm Nancy Wilson. Creating a musical identity can be a challenge for young musicians, and when your father is a musical legend, the challenge is twice as tough. The blues and boogie-woogie were the glue that held together the musical fabric of Chicago's South Side, where Eugene Ammons was born on April 14, 1925. His father, Albert Ammons, was the reigning king of boogie-woogie. The elder Ammons spent much of his life on the road during Eugene's childhood. But when Gene's dad was home, the house reverberated with the sounds of piano legends Mead Lux Lewis and Pete Johnson, who were frequent visitors. Is it any wonder that even as a bebopper late in the 1940s, Gene Ammons' style tapped the deep tradition of blues and boogie-woogie? Chicago jazz writer Neil Tesser.
I'm sure it didn't surprise anyone when the son of Albert Ammons became a musician. And in a way, at least in retrospect, it shouldn't surprise any of us that even though he was from a different generation, that he would be someone who was able to bridge that gap because he had heard so much of it.
Although not a star performer like his father, Gene's mother was also a pianist and played a major role in his love of music. Though she died when Gene was only a teenager, Gene had other mentors as well. At DeSable High School on Chicago's South Side, Ammons fell under the influence of the legendary Captain Walter Diet. The band instructor at DeSable was a tough disciplinarian, but his ability to motivate launched the careers of a number of his students, including Johnny Griffin, Clifford Jordan, Nat King Cole, and many others. In the early 1940s, the jazz and social clubs on Chicago's South Side lured many of Captain Diet's best students away from their schoolwork. Barely 16 years old, Ammons abandoned the classroom to join the band of trumpeter King Colax, Charles Walton.
Everybody has been with Colax. In fact, almost every jazz star of that period, everybody came along late, like up to Coltrane. Even, Cannonball played with him once a little bit.
By 1943, Gene Ammons had become the featured soloist in the King Colax band, giving the teenager his first chance to test his own sound. For young players in Chicago during these pre-bebop days, the starting point for the tenor saxophone was rooted in the sound of one man, Coleman Hawkins. Thank you. Hawkins' music was a major influence on Gene Ammons, but the young player was also struck by the more lyrical tones of tenor saxophonist Lester Young. Perhaps it was Ammons' ability to assimilate Hawk's big throaty tones with Lester's more subtle style that caught the ear of Billy Eckstine. When the singer-bandleader heard Gene solo in the Colax band, Eckstine hired him on the spot.
Hello, baby. I had to call you on the phone. Hello, baby. I had to call you on the phone.
Billy Eckstine's stylized vocals camouflaged what was going on behind the singer. The Eckstine Band was an incubator for the revolution that was coming. Still a teenager, Gene Ammons was hired just as Eckstine's band was giving birth to bebop in 1944. Charles Walton.
Billy Eckstine's band was the first bebop band. And they had all the bebop stars in it. Charlie Parker was there, Quick Minute, Dexter. Dizzy was the musical director for a minute, because there were constant changes in that band.
So blow Mr. Gene, blow Mr. Johnson too. Blow Mr. Gene, blow Mr. Johnson too. Maybe you can help me and blow away the blues.
In quick succession, the founding fathers of the bebop era passed through the Eckstine Band. They included Charlie Parker, Dizzy Gillespie, Fats Navarro, Art Blakey, Bud Johnson, Miles Davis, and Dexter Gordon. Ammons stayed with Eckstine for 3 years. With the new sound of bebop in his arsenal, and as Mr. B's hand-picked lead soloist, Jug was beginning to make a name for himself. Ammons left Eckstine to form his own quintet in 1947, and shortly after walking into his first recording studio as a leader, had his first hit. His widow, Mildred Ammons, nicknamed Red Top for her red hair, remembers the session well.
They would rehearse, and sometimes they would play this tune. Da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da. I said, what is the name of that? And he said, I haven't named it yet. And later on, they add a little bit more to it. So that's why he named Red Top. So I'm gonna name it for you.
Thank you. Gene Ammons' arrangement of Red Top, featuring Gene on tenor and Gail Brockman on trumpet. Mercury Records, the label that launched many of Boogie Woogie King Albert Ammons' records, now had another Ammons in its stable. So it was no surprise when the company put father and son in the studio together in the summer of 1947. And Gene Ammons performing Hiroshima with Ike Perkins on guitar and Israel Crosby on bass. With his hits on the jukebox and with accolades still fresh from the Eckstein Band, Gene Ammons was becoming a draw in Chicago clubs. And younger players behind him were beginning to mimic Gene's style. One of them was Harold Osley.
I remember he used to play a white Brillhart mouthpiece. So when my grandfather bought me a saxophone, and he was playing con at the time, I asked my grandfather to buy me a con saxophone, and I got a Brillhart mouthpiece, you know, because I wanted to get that sound that he got. Of course, I realized it wasn't just the mouthpiece or the horn.
It was more than the brand of mouthpiece that was enlarging the Gene Ammons sound. Junior Mance, Gene's pianist for many of the Mercury sessions, discovered one of his secrets.
He would buy a new mouthpiece, and then he would open it up more himself with a file. You know, nobody else could play his mouthpiece but him. You know, and they used to have a joke about Gene's mouthpiece was there was so much space between the reed and the top of the mouthpiece you could stick your fist through it. It was big. You could almost see through it, you know.
Gene Ammons, playing his 1947 tune, Harold the Fox, with Gail Brockman on trumpet, Junior Mance on piano, Gene Wright on bass, and Ellis Barty on drums. Still ahead on our tribute to Gene Ammons, the tenor saxophone battles of Jug and Sonny. I'm Nancy Wilson, and you're listening to Jazz Profiles from NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you. By the late 1940s, Gene Ammons had firmly rooted himself in the new sounds emerging from jazz. He developed his own sound in the Billy Eckstine Band, recorded with his father, Albert Ammons, and was leading his own groups. In 1949, Gene was invited to join Woody Herman's band. Tenor dynamo Stan Getz was leaving Herman's so-called second herd, and Woody needed a big sound to fill Getz's shoes. The Herd was noted for its tightly arranged ensemble of three tenors and a baritone saxophone. The Four Brothers, as it was known, hosted some of the biggest name performers of the day, including Zoot Sims, Al Cohn, Jimmy Giuffre, and Serge Shaloff. Herman also distinguished the band by its racial makeup. No other white band leader used as many black artists as Woody Herman. Prestige Records founder Bob Weinstock first saw Gene Ammons play in the Herman Band at the Apollo Theater in Harlem.
It was really a tribute for Woody to be there in this all-black neighborhood and theater. Gene came up and played on More Moon, and he tore the house down. So I knew right then and there Gene had a way of reaching the people.
The Shorty Rogers tune, More Moon, Woody Herman's second herd, with Gene Ammons on tenor saxophone. In the few short months he was with Woody Herman, Ammons had enhanced his reputation even more. But with his own recording career beginning to blossom, he was ready to move on. In 1950, Gene formed a musical alliance with saxophonist Sonny Stitt. Borrowing a successful gimmick from the old Eckstine band, Sonny and Gene created a musical phenomenon, a battle of the saxes, featuring a tenor duel at the heart of each tune. On the road and on vinyl, the audience loved it. Bob Weinstock watched a number of these sessions from his control room.
I tell you, I was sitting in the studio, and all of a sudden they said, okay, we're going to play that. And it was frightening. You know, the sound the two of them got was like frightening, you know? It was like almost like hearing a big band.
Sonny Stitt tended to be a person who was competitive.
Saxophonist Harold Osley.
So he prepared himself so that he could play in all keys, all tempos, you know, and whenever you played with him, you had to be able to deal with that. The fact that Gene was, he could play one note. He didn't have to play a whole lot of notes for people to be impressed with what he did. Gene might come in with just two, three notes and people would applaud.
For 2 years, Stitt and Ammons took their dueling tenors on the road to Detroit, Philadelphia, New York, and Boston. And Gene and Sonny's wives came along for the ride. Mildred Ammons.
He was married to a dancer, and we would be in New York and all, and we traveled together. We had a ton panel truck. I learned to drive it. She would be cooking our food in the back of the truck. And Sonny, he was a beautiful person. When they did Blues Up and Down, one would play their part. And Sonny was a fast fingerer. And Gene was more of a, his sound was the big sound. It was a little heavier than Sonny's. But they played beautiful together. Thank you.
Sonny Stitt left the band in 1952, but Gene continued to enjoy success in the studio and on the road. Putting much of that success on disc was Bob Weinstock, who had built his new prestige label around Gene Ammons' popular appeal. Unlike his competitors at Blue Note, Weinstock didn't rehearse and prepare his musicians for the studio. Instead, he simply assembled top-name performers for Gene and let them play.
I would get together some all-stars, younger players that were around New York, like Art Farmer, Jackie McLean, Lou Donaldson, Mal Waldron, Kenny Burrell, Paul Quinichet, even Coltrane was on one of those. I had the group ready for him. He'd just come in and record.
For many of these prestige sessions, Ammons wouldn't know who he'd be performing with or what he'd be playing until the moment he walked into the studio. Writer and prestige reissues producer, Bob Porter.
He would take a piece of sheet music like he did with Here's That Rainy Day from the first session and look at it, run it down, and he'd talk to Junior. And they would simply figure out how they were going to routine the tune. He would simply communicate that to the band, and boom, they would do it.
It's almost like he came to be in a show. He never rehearsed, never saw the people in the show. He did the show, and took a bow and left. And that's the way it was. And they were all one take.
For much of the 50s, prestige recorded Ammons in these all-star settings, and Gene's audience couldn't get enough. Despite all the attention paid to prestige artists, such as John Coltrane and Miles Davis, no one sold records like Gene Ammons. No one.
People always think Miles Davis was the bestseller. Gene Ammons outsold him by far, you know. Miles was really just restricted to the jazz audience. A lot of the stuff we put out by Gene Ammons went into R&B and you know, it spread out beyond the jazz field.
Sweet Jenny Lou,
Jenny Lou,
the time is right,
so right.
Sweet Jenny Lou,
let's spit some woo.
Too old, too tight,
yes, the night is right.
Ammons' ability to move freely from bebop to R&B in the recording studio was a carryover from his club dates. Even during his high-flying bebop days with the Eckstein Band, Gene always made time for the blues and some more soulful tunes when he returned to his Southside Chicago clubs. Bob Porter.
He could look at an audience and understand uniquely what he needed to play for that audience in order to make them happy. Now, if he was working in the Southside of Chicago or something like that, he would play his hits and he would emphasize the blues. If he was working on the north side of Chicago, he would play a more bebop repertoire and emphasize the standards and the ballads. He just had an instinctive feel for what to play for any given audience.
Thank you. Gene Ammons' Seed Shack, with Richard Wyans on piano, Doug Watkins on bass, and Ray Barreto on congas. You're listening to NPR's Jazz Profiles, a tribute to Gene Ammons. I'm Nancy Wilson. By the late 1950s, Jug was at the top of his game. A steady stream of jazz and R&B hits continued to stream out of Prestige, and the Ammons name on a club marquee guaranteed a full house. But it all came tumbling down in 1958, when Gene Ammons was convicted for narcotics possession. Gene's wife, Red Top, had seen the signs of addiction for a number of years.
But I kept begging him, why don't you do this, why don't you do that? We were in Philadelphia one time, and I said, wake up, wake up. I called the police on her. But we were still friends. When he came back, we were still all right.
Ammons served a 2-year sentence and was paroled, but returned to prison again for refusing to obey the parole board's orders to stay away from the music scene. When his prison term was up in 1960, he was finally allowed to pick up his horn again. When Ammons returned, a new instrument was replacing the piano in a number of popular jazz groups. The raspy tones from the Hammond B3 organ injected a new sense of soul and swing into many rhythm sections, and Gene liked what he heard. Players like Jimmy Smith, Richard Groove Holmes, and Jack McDuff were bridging jazz fans with the R&B audience. For Ammons, it was a tool to make his blues sound even bigger. Pianist Junior Mans.
He got very fascinated by the organ sound with tenor, and he had the perfect sound to blend with an organ. It was big and just low enough, you know, to really give a good sound, and I think this is what influenced them a lot in the rhythm and blues thing.
Jazz writer Neil Tesser.
The organ was a perfect correlative to that sound. You know, not every tenor player can work with an organ effectively because the organ can dwarf the sound. But nobody's going to dwarf Gene Ammons' sound. It just it became a sort of an army behind this rampaging general, and you know, just made him more formidable, I think.
Fresh out of prison, Gene Ammons had a fresh new sound. Producer Bob Porter.
This is the time when Gene Ammons really becomes established in my mind. And when he'd get onto a tune like Hitting a Jug, or Canadian Sunset from Boss Tenor, or Exactly Like You from the Jug album. I mean, those things just seem to be phrased perfectly. The melody would be phrased perfectly. You'd say to yourself, I don't know how you can do this better than what he's done. I think it's his greatest time. And he was strung out that entire time. We'll be right back.
Despite serving time, Ammons had not kicked his heroin habit. On a trip to the Midwest in September of 1962, Jug was busted again, this time on the much more serious charge of selling narcotics.
Oh, he was set up. They were working in Kansas City. And there was this guy in Kansas City, some real sleazebag, who started hanging around the band. And as Gene told me, he says he was, as he said, securing drugs for himself. But this guy kept hitting on him and hitting on him and hitting on him and wanted Gene to get some for him too. And finally, when he did it, he got busted. Somebody in Cook County had it in for him. And they really were out to nail him.
Set up or not, Ammon served 7 more years in prison. Gene was out of the public eye for most of the 1960s, an absence that would spell disaster for most musicians. But his old friend at Prestige, Bob Weinstock, was able to continue releasing new material. Perhaps seeing the handwriting on the wall, Weinstock stockpiled a number of Ammon's earlier studio sessions.
In the music business, out of sight, out of mind is a general rule. If you go 3 or 4 years without a record, people don't know who the hell you are. But with Gene and the way Weinstock operated in this particular time, they managed to keep a regular stream of releases coming.
In jail, Ammons was allowed to play a saxophone. Gene directed and wrote for the prison band and taught some of its members. Occasionally, major jazz artists visited and performed at the prison, and Gene sat in. I'm one of those jazz artists who went to that prison, and Gene sat in. It was all his way of keeping his chops in shape for his eventual freedom. Ammon's release from prison in 1969 was trumpeted by the jazz press. One of the giants of the tenor saxophone is finally back on the scene, was the headline in Downbeat magazine. Within 2 weeks of his release, Ammons performed at Chicago's Plugged Nickel to a packed crowd. Days later, he returned to New Jersey to the studios where he cut many of his early Prestige hits. The Boss Is Back proved beyond a doubt that Ammons had lost none of his gutsy style or his ability to reach out to an audience. For the next 4 years, Gene continued to record at a fast clip for Prestige, including sessions with Dexter Gordon and a live recording at the Montreux Jazz Festival with Dexter Gordon and Cannonball Adderley. But in 1974, Gene was diagnosed with bone cancer. He had also been coping with a number of health problems, which surfaced during his prison years. On August 6, 1974, Gene Ammons died, but not before releasing one final recording for Prestige. Perhaps understanding the seriousness of his illness The final tune recorded for the album was Goodbye, written by Gordon Jenkins. More than 25 years after the passing of Gene Ammons, a number of younger ears are now rediscovering Jug's big round sound. And they're wondering out loud why so little room has been left for Ammons in the jazz history books. Ammons made recordings that created solid hits spanning four decades. Fellow musicians like Dexter Gordon, John Coltrane, and Jackie McLean had profound respect for Gene's sound. Yet for much of his career, Gene was ignored by the jazz establishment. Chicago radio host and writer John Corbett.
He was part of something called soul jazz that had an appeal that was made into jukebox records, that was danced to, that had funky names that were easily dismissed by a critical establishment that was interested in having a scapegoat for that kind of thing. And so the fact that he had this tone, the fact that he had this approach that did have a sort of gutsiness and earthiness to it, made him an easy target for those critics.
In 1961, Ammons offered Metronome magazine some advice for young musicians. Ammons told the interviewer, "I would tell them to get a sound, practice their sound. That's the most important thing." In recent years, more than one young tenor player has discovered the Gene Ammons sound. Anyone listened to Ammons' advice, it was 40-year-old Ellery Eskelin playing saxophone here. In 1996, he recorded The Sun Died, an entire album of Ammons' tunes, updated with his own modern style. Eskelin found Jug's lyrical qualities and his approach to tone rich in feeling and meaning, and very alive today.
It's the reason that I think he's so important. I think that immediacy that you hear in his sound. I mean, there's really just to have an example of somebody who was that emotionally direct with a saxophone and also very sophisticated and like I said before, a certain type of elegance wedded with that almost raw kind of sound. That's timeless. I think that's always going to be relevant and important.
Our tribute to Gene Ammons was produced, written, and mixed by Greg Fitzgerald, with production assistance from Amy Vollmer and Muriel Litchfield. Our editor was Molly Murphy. Jazz Profiles is produced by Tim Owens, assistant producer Madeline Smith. The administrative assistant is Linda Broen, website coordinator John Murph. Special thanks to the Jazz Institute of Chicago and Terry Hinty of Prestige Records. We had technical help from NPR's New York and Los Angeles bureaus and Steve Malagodi of WLRN in Miami. To email us for more information about this and other programs in our series, contact us through NPR's homepage on the World Wide Web at npr.org. That's npr.org. Major support for Jazz Profiles comes from the Wallace Reader's Digest Funds, seeking to enrich community life through support of education, arts, and culture. Additional support has been provided by the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm Nancy Wilson. This is NPR, National Public Radio.